It's Wednesday, April 18th, 2018, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, a lot of politics to talk about. We'll talk about Sean Hannity, Michael Cohen's mystery client, and whether he had an obligation to disclose that before it came out in open court. We'll talk about the coverage of Friday night's airstrikes in Syria. Rachel Maddow waited all of about 30 seconds following the president's remarks before making it political, and tying it in part to the raid on Cohen's home and the highly publicized clips coming out in advance of that special on ABC Sunday night. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll talk to before our time's up, but we're going to start with something a little bit closer to home, Governor Greitens and his growing legal issues. Yesterday, Attorney General Josh Hawley announced he has more than enough evidence to support felony charges against the governor connected to the Mission Continues, then that if the circuit attorney in St. Louis is ready to file charges there, that she can, but needs to act fast because the statute of limitations will soon run out. Hawley told reporters that this announcement was made without giving the governor a heads up that it was coming. Last Wednesday, Hawley, who you probably know is running against Claire McCaskill for U.S. Senate, called for the governor to resign after the House of Representatives released its report into the investigation into his affair and alleged blackmail of his former hairdresser. Here's what the governor said in response to that.
I want to say again what I've said from the beginning. This is a political witch hunt. But the people of Missouri see through this, and they know far better than to trust one-sided tabloid trash gossip that was produced in a secret report. And all of you should know that that deeply felt honor, right, inspires me every day. And that I will continue to serve the people of Missouri as their governor and to work for you every day.
That resolve and that commitment to stay in office ringing just as true today after Hawley's announcements yesterday. I will say one thing, reporters down in Jefferson City and here in mid-Missouri, east, west, north, and south, they are working overtime working on this story.
Because it is the story. I mean, you have this governor who basically, when he came into office, the governor, the legislature, many of the statewide offices are all Republican. And now what you have is the party itself trying to get rid of this governor because they are afraid that he's going to bring down what they've built up. And their whole goal was to try to get Claire McCaskill, the one big office holder Democrat, out. And this has the potential to pretty much do away with all of that work.
Which is kind of ironic because Claire McCaskill won 5 years ago because of Todd Akin's comments. It's kind of like, you know, what do they say? 1-0 oops, wipes out 10 attaboys.
Well,
I censored that language.
I think, too, that from the media's perspective, I mean, one, this is a great story, of course, as Ernest just said, but there's no love lost between the press corps and the governor either. I mean, whether it's him not holding news conferences, using apps to hide documents and meetings and conversations having with his staff, all that stuff going on.
Yeah, that investigation's still going on.
Of course, you've got the Senate race on top of all this. I thought it was interesting because maybe the thing that Hawley just did, although in some ways it's pretty transparently political, might be of more difficulty for the governor than the accusations of the sexual misconduct is. In some ways, the latter is more he said, she said, and there's still going to be a court case about that. But what Hawley's bringing up, saying you took money from your charity, or you took the list from your charity and used it to raise money for your campaign, there's not a lot of question as to whether or not that, if documented, is illegal.
And I think, you know, not that they didn't already have Republicans calling for him to resign, but now, I mean, you have the entire Republican leadership basically saying, because of what Hawley did yesterday, you need to resign, and if not, we are going to immediately, and that's the thing right. That really jumped out at me, we're going to immediately open up proceedings to have you impeached.
It's interesting because it's not a coincidence that the governor is using the terms witch hunt and fake news over and over and over again. We know where he's getting those lines. I'm not sure that they're going to work for him. And in fact, I'm not sure at this point, even this whole notion that we should allow the legal process to play out is going to help him. Yes, he's going to go to court in, 3 weeks or whatever, and he'll either be acquitted or he won't, or he'll be convicted. But by then, I'm not sure it matters. Right. Because at this point, the Republican Party sees the governor as an albatross, and it doesn't matter whether he's convicted.
Yeah, when you start looking at the way the media has covered this, I mean, the initial allegations came out. He definitely was going after him. He was using all of the same tactics that President Trump has used. But as the investigations have taken place, now all of a sudden he's sort of shifted into this bunker mentality of, I'm not going to resign, you're going to see what's going to happen. And he's really not paying much attention to or calling out the media for what's going on. He's basically trying to put out the fires, or the huge fires that are going on within his own camp and what's happening to him in terms of the party pushing him out. Or at least trying to push him out.
I do want to say, before we move on to our next topic, just because I feel obligated to, for our listeners who are going to be listening to this on KBIA on the radio itself, this program doesn't air until 6:30 on Wednesday evenings. We recorded at 1:15. So everything we just discussed, I hope, stands up still at 7 o'clock. But just in case, know that that is because we were recording earlier. Just in case it's still fluid, it could be changing. Yeah. So there was a little nugget to come out of a federal courtroom in New York. Michael Cohen, President Trump's fixer, his mysterious third client, none other than Fox News talk show host and unofficial Trump advisor, Sean Hannity. Here's how it was reported Monday afternoon on Fox News.
In today's proceedings that are underway right now, Stephen Ryan, one of Cohen's attorneys, was asked by the judge to specifically name the other name because they said it would not fall under attorney-client privilege to withhold that name. And he stood up and named him as Sean Hannity. So moving on to the rest of what's happening today.
Of course, for us, the elephant in the room at the moment is that Sean Hannity is said to have, according to court documents, been a third client of Michael Cohen. There's a statement at the Hollywood Reporter from Hannity that says, you know, we've been friends a long time. He did some legal work for me. Hannity's producers are working to contact him. Since it's now part of the story, we'll report on it when we know the rest of it. A lot of people here know his number, so we'll get on that in just a second.
You could hear the breath. I know, that was kind of funny. You could hear the breath that the reporter took before saying his name, and Shepard Smith almost didn't even know what to say at that. Hannity addressed it on his afternoon radio program and then on Twitter and again on his primetime program on Fox News Channel. Here's part of that first explanation.
Michael never represented me in any matter. I never retained him in the traditional sense as retaining a lawyer. I never received an invoice from Michael. I never paid legal fees to Michael. But I have occasionally had brief discussions with him about legal questions about which I wanted his input and perspective. And I assume that those conversations were attorney-client confidential. And the other thing I will need to point out to the media that is apparently going insane over this, not one of any issue I ever dealt with Michael Cohen on ever involved a matter between me and any third party.
So here's where things start to get a little bit hazy for me based on some of the readings that I had done between Monday night and now, because in some of them and part of that conversation, he said that he would sometimes slip a $10 bill to Cohen with the thought that that would enact attorney-client privilege. If that's the case, I don't know. That makes him a client, doesn't it?
Yeah, his whole explanation doesn't pass the smell test, because I'm not a client, but I maybe gave him some money or I sought some advice. I'm not a client, but both I and Cohen tried to keep the information from being revealed to the public that I was one of three people on his client list. So I don't think you can have it both ways.
He's a client. I mean, that's the way it is. I mean, you had a conversation, you slipped him some money, you had this sort of perception of attorney-client privilege that you shouldn't talk to anyone else about what we've been talking about. You're a client at that point. I mean, I it's going to be hard for his attorneys to go into court and sort of try to walk this fine line that he's building, which to me, just it's just not there.
So, you know, you've got that argument. He's not a journalist. He's a commentator. But when the ethics come into play here, did the audience deserve to know that information ahead of time, given the amount of time he would devote to talking about Donald Trump and Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels on the show? Did they need to know that he had that relationship with Cohen?
I think so. I mean, he has no obligation to reveal who his attorney is. Mm-hmm. Except in the context of him being on the air railing against the raid on Michael Cohen's office and not acknowledging, oh, and by the way, I'm one of the few people who is listed as a client of his. That's a problem, even if not for Hannity. I mean, he might be able to make the case, I'm not a journalist, I'm a commentator. But for Fox News Channel, it's a problem. And yet they're coming out at least initially and saying, we looked into this, he has our full support, nothing here.
That doesn't surprise me. I mean, you're right in terms of this is a problem for Fox News, because now you've got one of the last old guard commentators, because all the others have been run out.
Bill O'Reilly, gone.
Yeah, you know, so, you know.
It would leave him with Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham, who has her own issues.
She's got her own issues right now. So right now you've got, I mean, he's the big draw now. Mm-hmm. And now you have the possibility of him being exited stage left. So, you know,
really
of course,
think that's going to happen.
Well, I don't know if it's going to happen. I think a lot of it's going to be determined by what happens in this case. But there's always that possibility there. And so now they're scrambling, trying to figure out, OK, what are we going to do here? We need to cover it because we are a news operation. So we need to cover it. However, you know, he's going to be talking about this on his show and that whole problem of divorcing commentary from news, again, hits Fox in the wrong spot.
I don't think the revelation itself that he was a client and the questions that we're talking about with whether it's a conflict of interest or whatever, I don't think that's going to bring him down, given his unique relationship to the audience and Fox's unique relationship to their audience. But what's going to come out? Were there recordings with Sean Hannity? What is there that the federal prosecutors are looking into? Because Kimba Wood, the federal judge in New York who's handling this case, a Clinton appointee, is not giving any favors to the Trump team or the Cohen team.
And she was the one who pushed to get them to name the names.
And she said, I'm not going to let you have first look at this information and try to decide what should be excluded and what shouldn't. We're going to let the prosecutors go through their
or
regular process.
Or a special master.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so here's a little fun fact for you. Every one of the New York Times bestsellers on the nonfiction side so far this year, they have all been about Donald Trump. And now we've got a new one, this one from James Comey, his book released yesterday. Sunday night, ABC aired its first television interview, the first one Comey did with anyone. I made it up through about the first half of it or so, but I didn't really feel like I learned anything new or hadn't already seen anything that was in any of the tidbits or little bits that had been released starting Friday.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder how that's going to affect book sales. I mean, at the moment, Comey's book is number one on Amazon. It's too early to have any numbers for the New York Times bestseller list. It's probably going to sell a lot of books. But all of these interviews, which are basically letting out the good stuff in advance of somebody buying the book, you have to wonder. I bought the book, downloaded it early Tuesday morning, read about half of it, and haven't gotten to the current stuff with Trump yet. But I'm not really sure how many people...
Wait. So hold on. Yeah. You're about halfway through the book and still haven't gotten to the current stuff with Trump yet.
This is all about Comey's story from the day when he was a high school kid and a serial rapist broke into his home and threatened his life and his brother's life, all the way up through his college years to all the different jobs he had as a federal prosecutor.
Is it interesting?
Well, some of it is interesting. Here's basically the deal, in my reading of it so far.
Okay.
The whole theme of this book is about bullies and cowards. I mean, that's what the book is about. And there are bullies that he's run up against, and Trump isn't the only bully. He names a lot of other people, Vice President Dick Cheney and one of his chief legal aides and some other folks. There were also people who were cowards, like Alberto Gonzalez, who was the attorney general in the Bush administration, who didn't want to fight back to say that what the Bush administration was doing was torture with some of the people the CIA was holding. So his book is mostly about, here are the people who are the bullies, here are the people who are the cowards, and here are the few folks who are the heroes in this whole thing.
I saw one of the interviews, the interview you did this morning on the Today Show, and I was watching it, and I usually don't watch the Today Show, but he was there. And what I find fascinating is all of the questions from the ABC interview to the NBC interview to what NPR had, they're all the same.
Mm-hmm.
And no new information is coming out. It's not anything that we didn't already know from his testimony before Congress. So it's almost as if, you know, he's got this book tour going on each and every network, and someone is hoping that he's going to say something that we don't already know, and he's not doing that.
I actually thought there was an interesting piece on NPR yesterday where they were interviewing John Dean, giving him advice on what he should do while he was out on his book tour, to be very careful that the story he tells in one interview is not marginally different from the story he tells in another interview or that's in his book, because that makes him culpable whenever he's a witness or for the investigation of Trump.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I want to shift gears just a little bit and ask you about the coverage Friday night and into the weekend of the airstrikes in Syria. The president addressed the nation, explaining what happened, and he provided a very, very basic plan as to what was to come next. And, well, it seemed like within about 30 seconds of his wrapping up, Rachel Maddow was already saying this on MSNBC.
There are national security consequences to having a presidency that is as chaotic as Mr. Trump's presidency, a presidency that is as consumed by scandal and criminal intrigue as his presidency is. It has national security consequences. When the president orders missile strikes on Syria on a night like tonight, the strategic effect of that strike will be assessed by both our allies and our enemies. Other countries and entities involved in the fight in Syria or considering their role in Syria are going to try to figure out how they're going to react to this U.S. strike. It will affect those other countries' view of this strike. It will affect their reaction to it. It will therefore affect the utility of this military strike. If the President of the United States is believed to have issued the order to launch this strike tonight, even in part because people think he wanted to distract from a catastrophic domestic scandal that is blowing up at home at the same time, the perception that the President may have ordered these strikes in part because of scandal, will affect the impact and the effectiveness of these military strikes. Unavoidably. I mean, even if the tail is not wagging the dog, even if you give the president every benefit of the doubt, even if his calculations about whether to launch this action against Syria tonight was taken with absolutely no regard for what else is going on in the president's life right now, what else is going on in the president's life right now unavoidably creates a real perception around the globe that that may have been part of the motivation, both for what he did and particularly for when he did it.
So, you know, we've often talked about how this administration will try and deflect attention away from anything it doesn't want to address, and that there's no question it's happened in the past. But there's also no question the Trump administration had a really bad week last week. But I was watching this, and I'll tell you, I didn't even stay with the whole thing when I was watching it live Friday night, because my first thought was, it's too soon. There's still missiles that are flying in Syria. I want to know what's happening. I don't want to hear your soliloquy and your diatribe.
Well, I mean, but that's what you're getting when you turn on MSNBC. I mean, every decision that's made within the White House gets turned into a political opportunity to go after the president, to go after one.
Okay, I would understand that. But yeah. Shouldn't there be a respectful amount of time? I don't know, a minute before we get to that point?
But this is the cable news environment in which we live.
Yeah, I'm afraid that they've really calculated exactly what their audience wants, and they're going to give that to them. I was watching last night, and Rachel Maddow is doing something that they're full anti-Trump mode, and that's her right to do it. Her audience wants to hear that stuff. While at the same time, over on CNN and on all the online outlets, news outlets, we're finding out that Barbara Bush died. Yeah. And maybe that's a big story, but it doesn't match the narrative that the show is trying to put out there. And so she didn't do it. On the other hand.
So let me ask you, and we will come back to on the other hand in a minute. What were they harping on? Was it at that point the Washington Post news about Pompeo going to North Korea, or was it something else?
That was one of the stories, and okay. There were some other stories as well. But the point was, there was no acknowledgement even that the former First Lady had died, right? And that was important. But all that being said, there's nothing wrong with drawing inferences about mm-hmm. whether this is a wag the dog moment. And she wasn't the only one who did it. Brian Stelter, the media reporter at CNN, was suggesting that in a piece he wrote. And it is true, what was it, back in 1998, President Clinton did a similar thing when the Monica Lewinsky scandal was in full bloom. And a lot of reporters talked about whether or not at that point it was a wag the dog situation.
But the problem I have with this is that you knew something was coming because they've been talking about it for days.
Right.
And they've been talking about, we're not going to do this in isolation. We're going to do this along with our allies, which is what ultimately happened. So, you know, I have a problem with not at least acknowledging that the situation is still going on and giving us the news. And then if you want to go after it for politics, that's fine. But, you know, I'm sort of on your camp with this.
Well, we're looking for consistency, and so rarely does that happen anymore.
True.
I mean, frankly, you know, earlier in the week, Rachel Maddow and a lot of other folks were saying, Mr. President, you said in 24 to 48 hours this you're going to do something about these attacks on these children and women in Syria. So okay. Don't look for consistency.
Okay, fair enough. We do have some other topics to talk about today that aren't so political. Among them, big honors for Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey sharing the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service Journalism with Ronan Farrow for their coverage of the Harvey Weinstein scandal, breaking open the Me Too and Time's Up movements. It's not so much a surprise that they won. It was pretty much expected that it was going to happen. The big question going into Monday's announcement was, is it going to be the New York Times, the New Yorker, or both? And not all that common for it to go and to be a shared prize like that.
No, it's not uncommon. What I found interesting was the fact that the committee, I mean, at least the one part of the committee wanted to give it to, I think, the New Yorker, and then the committee as a whole decided we're going to give it to everyone. And that didn't just happen with that story. It also happened, the same thing happened with the New York Times and the Washington Post getting a Pulitzer Prize for their coverage of the Russia investigation.
And the a topic we talked about very heavily on this program, the investigation into the Alabama Senate race
and how
some of those interviews were conducted.
Right.
Well, so going back to the prize that the New York Times and the New Yorker shared, I mean, I think it was the right call.
Oh, I think it was the right call.
You could imagine how the New Yorker might not even been in the conversation had NBC News not refused to take Ronan Farrow's story and put it on the air. But, you know, I also thought the Washington Post investigative reporting Pulitzer made sense, too, because that Alabama Senate race, I think it would have turned out quite differently without the investigative
reporting. I mean, the dogged investigation that they did. I mean, because you just, and this goes to when you have national newspapers like the Times and the Post that are out there doing this kind of work, I think it's important because you don't have that kind of journalism on the ground locally or even regionally to be able to do that because of the economic constraints that are now hurting the local news in those areas.
Okay, well, before we go, we have a couple of voices that have kept us company really for decades. The first needs no introduction to overnight listeners of KFRU for more than, I don't know, decades.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you may be in the world's time zones, each and every one covered like a blanket by this program, Coast to Coast AM.
Art Bell died Friday, ironically, Friday the 13th in Nevada. We don't yet know the cause. You know, I first started listening to Art Bell back in the late 90s when I was working early morning shifts at KUMU, and KFRU at the time was the only news talk radio station really available in town. And he scared the heck out of me when that would come out on my alarm clock, and then I'd have to drive on like the totally dark country roads to get from my apartment here in town out to KUMU. I don't know. It's a voice that's been missing for a while.
And, you know, if for somebody
you know,
who traffic-
driving the bust crazy town, but it's a voice that's been missing for a while.
Yeah, I mean, for somebody who trafficked in conspiracy theories and UFOs and all that kind of stuff, he had a very loyal audience and they really loved him. I mean, he didn't come across as crazy while talking about crazy subjects.
Right. He wasn't completely innocent in everything, though. There's a lot of controversy about topics that he had on, especially as it related to the Hale-Bopp comet and what happened with people is that went by in the mass suicides there. There was another voice that we lost yesterday, that very familiar to NPR audiences, Carl Castle, passing away as well.
I mean, Carl Castle had been with NPR since, what, 1975 or something? They had a nice remembrance of him during All Things Considered yesterday. But he moved all the way up from being like a disc jockey in commercial radio to being the voice of Morning Edition along with Bob Edwards. I mean, he did all those newscasts for all those years. And probably most people who are under the age of 40 remember him for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. I mean, a totally different career shift, but still public media.
My first thought was, well, I guess he won't be doing my outgoing answering machine message, right? That being right. The prize on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It's interesting. We talk about some of these voices that we're losing. We're not listening to terrestrial radio in the same way anymore to have these shared experiences and to have these voices that people across the country are really able to unite around, listen to, and create some of these legends over time.
Yeah, I think that, but I do think that NPR is trying to build that back into, because they've always been known for that, but you know, after Carl left, and you still have some people whose voices you recognize, but they're trying to bring in new people to try to build to try to build that out to a new generation, and I think if they sort of follow that same path, they'll be able to get there.
I mean, I do think that NPR is doing a good job through its podcast of keeping people interested in talent and unique voices. But as you say, because of the way it's being distributed, where it's not an appointment listening situation anymore, not always sure that it's going to bring the country together, as you suggested, as ways that, say, that Carl Castle or Bob Edwards or other folks used to do.
But I think it does have the possibility, the podcast that you mentioned, it does have the possibility to bring certain segments of audiences together. It may not be appointment radio, because we don't have appointment television either.
Yeah.
But I do think that that is a way to sort of bring at least segments of audiences together.
Well, I do hope that that does happen as you're talking about it, and that we do start to see some of these personalities come together who have the longevity in the industry that we're kind of talking about.
Can I suggest one quick thing? Please going do. Back to our previous topic? We're talking about the Pulitzers and a lot of the focus on national stories. Mm-hmm. Look at the papers that won the local reporting category, like the Cincinnati Inquirer. Did a story about heroin abuse, and the other nominees that were in that category. It's really good to see how local news organizations are trying to rise above all the problems we keep talking about to do the kind of journalism that people really need.
Well, and the fact that, you know, you had, you know, rap, hip hop. Come out as a winner of the Pulitzer. I mean, that's huge. That's huge. I mean, it gives them cachet that they hadn't had before.
It's a sign of shifting changes in tastes and attitudes.
Yeah.
And all of that. Well, that music means we are pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about all of the topics we talked about today. That's on our links blog. It's under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, to leave us comments and questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next time, and more. Programming note, we're going to be off next week, back in two. I'd like to thank RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio for us. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. Austin Howard is our associate producer, and I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again in 2 weeks when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.